turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 93, and what this is it is a message of the, or a recording of the messages that I delivered to the church in which I pastored, Mount Taylor Baptist Church, this last Sunday, from Exodus chapter 14 on the Red Sea crossing. And of course, the Red Sea crossing is a remarkable act of God whereby he is able to deliver his people and demonstrate his power over the Egyptians. And a great message for you. Hopefully you'll be able to be encouraged by that and be challenged to faith in it. But before we listen to that, I want to direct you to a few announcements. First of all, our affiliate focus for today. First up is Envelopes. Envelopes is online the best system available for managing your money. If you were to carry around hard envelopes and then take out money from each category of those envelopes to purchase items as you go throughout the month, that would be an old-fashioned envelope system. Well, the envelopes system online is basically doing the same thing, only all computerized. And so it eliminates the whole process of having to use cash, but manages it just the same way. And so you can designate categories for your budget, and then as you spend from those categories, the budget amount goes down. It's a great program. I think you can get the first month free, and after that, it's $8 or $9 a month, and a great resource for managing your money. So check out Envelopes. Second up is Vision Forum. Vision Forum, reason why I like them is because they are a great resource for families to find family-friendly toys, family-friendly resources, especially if you are interested in building any kind of spiritual legacy, discipling your children in the faith, and developing a good understanding of history, good understanding of a worldview when it comes to husbands and wives and the relationship that they have and the family and all these kinds of things. You can find just a plethora of information from Vision Forum, whether it be in book form, audio form, or video form. They have it there. So check out Vision Forum. Christmas time is coming up. It's a great time to access their catalog. And if you do have their catalog and you're a regular user of Vision Forum, I encourage you to, for no extra cost, go through my website and click on the banner on the center right column where all the affiliates are. And that way you will actually be going through my website to access their website. And by doing so, I can get a little bit of commission on any purchase that you make. So I'd appreciate that. That helps support the show. Also, I would encourage you to become a user of the Legacy Podcast. By being a user of the Legacy Podcast, you then are able to access the comment section and provide comments to each of the shows. But you're also able to get email updates anytime that there is a change made to the website, anytime I make a post, blog post, or any kind of media post or anything like that, you will be notified through email when those happen so that you can keep abreast of all the new things that are coming out. And then also I want to encourage you to friend us and share us on all the various social media. So that would be YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. And then finally, if you like the show and you want to become a supporter of the show, the best way to do that is become a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year, and with that you have exclusive access to our members only page, and that enables you to have some downloadable material. There's a book on there about money. There's also some gardening and farming charts and graphs that you can download and use. There's a debt snowball program and some other information that you can use. There's just vendor discounts. And so there's all total over $50 worth of value. Plus, you're able to support the show at less than a quarter an episode. So consider becoming a Legacy Partner. You can do all that on the right column of the website. And there'll also be notes. There'll also be a link in the show notes. That takes care of the introductory segment. So now let's go ahead and listen to the message that I preached to the church of Mount Tabor Baptist Church yesterday at from Exodus chapter 14 on the Red Sea crossing. So I said earlier, we're going to be in Exodus chapter 14, if you wanted to follow along.
While you're turning there, let me say that every boy's adventure is to try to find a way across the river without getting wet. If you remember being a boy and going hiking maybe across a river, and or even as a boy, you probably had experiences here on the James River where on a low time of the year, you saw a little island out there and you thought, you know, I can probably get out there somehow and try to figure out a way maybe to get out there. I remember we had a couple occasions when I was growing up. I lived in Alaska for a while, and you know, we had really severe tides. The further north and the further south you go away from the equator, the larger the effect of the moon is on the tides. And so we had really extreme tides in Alaska. And there were periods of time where you could actually go out to places where you would never be able to get to without a boat otherwise because of low tides. And so there was this one beach in particular that we'd like to go to. And on occasions when it was really low tide, we would be able to walk out to those islands. And it was a little bit muddy, but we wouldn't have any water. And but we had to always watch our time because as the tide would start coming back in, it would start to fill that gap between where the island was and where we were. And if we weren't careful, we'd be stuck on the little island without a way to get back. And so we had to be real careful of that. And I remember one time also, when I lived in Montana, we had this little slough in the backyard. And we were always trying to figure out a way to get across. And so anytime there was a windstorm, we would go down there and we would look for any trees that had fallen down so that we might be able to walk across those trees and get to the other side. That's a boy's adventure. And that's why it seems like, you all like Indiana Jones? Indiana Jones is one of those good shows to watch. At least, most of the time they are. I wouldn't say they're necessarily the most upstanding of shows, but they're fun adventure shows. And there's one in particular I remember. It seems like in all of his shows there's that suspension bridge scene. You know what I'm talking about? Where there's that suspended bridge that goes across the big cavern with the river underneath or the lake or whatever it is. And Indiana Jones has to make it across. And it seems like just as he's about ready to get across, what happens to the bridge? Starts to fall in, right? And then the people that are on the bridge trying to chase after him, they end up falling down and he survives. That's the way the story goes, right? There's a very drama and adventuresome scene when it comes to that. Well, I can only imagine the drama that is taken up when the children of Israel are trapped between the sea of the Red Sea on one hand and the armies of Egypt on the other hand. And you can imagine the suspense that is built up in them at that point. And so this is one of the most fantastic of stories in the Scripture, and yet is a great story for us to rehearse as we go through the text. And what we have is, I worked really hard on trying to make all of these R's, okay, the outline. So if you notice on the outline, they're all R's. And I worked really hard. Graham and I had to, come up really deep thinking and look at the thesaurus and try to figure out some R's. And so you can't make fun of my R's, okay, as we go through this. But the outline is as follows. In verses 1 through 4, we have God's redirection. And it seems, although we don't understand where some of these names are, because the geography has changed extensively in that region, and the names have been changed as different people had conquered Egypt, and the ancient names had been changed over time, the Greek names have been changed to Islamic names, the Muslim names, Arabic names. And so the region has changed dramatically over time, so it's really quite unsure exactly where they were. But the idea seems to be that when they left Egypt, they were going in one way, and God was directing them in one way. And then when they got to a certain place, he called them back almost as though they were going back towards Egypt to go a different way. And by doing that, what he was doing is he was showing the Pharaoh that it looked as though the Egyptians were bewildered. It looked as though they were in this land with nowhere to go. It was as though they were wandering around with no direction. And so, of course, the Pharaoh looked at that and he says, aha, perfect time to strike. When they're confused, when they're bewildered, when they don't know where to go, it's a great time for us to strike. And so it says in verses 1 through 4, now the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So there we have the people's redirection. God redirects the people of Israel. And then in verses 5 through 9, we have Pharaoh's regret. And what we see here is we see that although Pharaoh let the people of Israel go, he now regrets it. It had been probably 3 days, and if you recall in the incident, Moses said, we're going to go 3 days into the wilderness to worship. And it had been longer than 3 days. And probably their labor force had diminished. Their building projects had stopped. The nation had been at a crossroads. And the Pharaoh asks himself, why in the world did we let the people of Egypt or the people of Israel go? We need them back. And so he goes out to try to get them back. In verse 5 it says, now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled. And the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this? That we have let the people of Israel go from serving us. So he has great regret in what he has done. And so what does he do? He sends out his chariots. Verse 7. He took 600 of his choice chariots along with all the other chariots. Now the choice chariots were the chariots themselves were actually designed by the Egyptians during the period in which Israel was down in the Egyptian lands. And they had two different kinds of chariots. They had the regular chariots that were manned by one person. And then they had the choice chariots. And these were like a three-man tank. They were a three-man chariot, the choice chariots. And so what Pharaoh does is he gathers all of his armed men, all of his horses, all of his chariots, both the choice chariots and these other ones. And so he's got this whole army, probably the greatest army at the then-known time. And they are going out against these unarmed slaves that had been delivered by God in the wilderness as they are camped beside the sea. And it says in verse 8, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, the king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses, all the chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal Zephon. So I want you to put yourself in the Israelite people for a moment. And imagine you've been wandering around the wilderness for 3 days. You've experienced a measure of freedom because you're no longer having to work as a task, work on the taskmasters of the Egyptians. And you've been told you're going to a promised land. And you get beside the Red Sea and you look over the Red Sea and you think, man, how are we going to get across that thing? And then all of a sudden you hear this noise behind you. And you look, and off in the distance you see dust coming up into the sky. And as you get closer, as it gets closer, you realize it's not a dust storm, but it's the armies of Egypt coming out after you. Well, most of us in a situation like that would probably be much like the Israelites and begin to cry. That's what we see the Israelites do. The Israelites have some reservations, and then Moses has some reassurance in verses 10 through 14. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Now, I have to explain here that archaeologists have found that there were a great deal of bones in this region of Egypt. And some scholars have thought that this may have been a dumping ground for bodies. After they had died in Egypt, they had been taken out into this wilderness area and their bones had been dumped. And so, as you might imagine, as the Israelites are traveling through here and they're seeing bone after bone after bone laying out here in the desert, and they're thinking to themselves, now we're trapped. The Egyptians are coming after us. Moses brought us out here so that we can be like these dead bones around us. So they began to cry out, why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? Isn't that funny? God was leading them out. He had given them great victory. He had given them deliverance through the 10 plagues from the mightiest nation in the then known world. Through all his miraculous work. He had delivered them, and now they're out in that region, and they begin to cry out saying, I wish I was back being a slave again. Why'd you bring us out here to die? It says, for I would have rather been better for us to have served the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. But what does Moses say to this? He reassures them. He says in verse 13, and Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. He will accomplish this for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. So what does Moses do? He says, why are you crying to me? Behold the power of God. He's going to deliver us. So he reassures them. Their fear is replaced with faith, or should be replaced with faith. This demonstrates to us that the mercy of God that delivers not just the faithful men, but he also delivers out of his mercy and grace. It didn't take very long for the Israelites to start grumbling and complaining. And we see this as a pattern over and over again with them. And yet God was faithful to deliver them. And then in verses 15 through 18, we see God's resolution. And what does God resolve to do? God resolves that he is going to make a path for them through the Red Sea so that they might be delivered. So verse 15, it says, and the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Now, if you remember, they're standing here at the sea, and they're seeing the sea, and it's just a big open ocean, and they're not able to get through it. They look behind them, and the Egyptians are coming. And God says, why are they standing here? Tell them to go on through the water. But he doesn't just say go on through the water. He actually tells Moses to hold up his staff in verse 16. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel should go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. Now, there wasn't anything magical about his staff or his rod. It wasn't anything particular that he had that was some special amulet or some special artifact that when he used it, it was like a magic. It was actually God working through him. And he just happened to use the staff as a symbol of God's power. When he raised it up, it was then able to part the waters or do many of the other things he did in the 10 plagues. So verse 17. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over the Pharaoh, and over all of his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over the Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And then in verses 19 through 20, we see the knight's rampart. Now, I know that was a difficult one to come up with, the knight's rampart. But let me explain what I mean here. A rampart is a barrier. It is a wall or some kind of barrier that prevents one group from coming to another group. And so we have in our Star Spangled Banner, the rampart is talked about being that thing where we can able to see the barrier of the enemy and the flag standing on the rampart. And so the idea is that there is this barrier between one and the other. And we see that here in verse 19. It says, and the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. So there is this angel that is leading them out. And it's a pillar of fire by night. And it's a cloud during the day that protects them from the sun during the day and gives them light at night. And for most of the time, it travels in front of them. But at this point, it stops. It's no longer between them and the sea, but it actually goes between them, between the Israelites and the Egyptians. And so it works as this rampart, separating the two. And it says that because of this, they did not come together at all throughout the night. Verse 20, so it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud of darkness to the one, and it gave light to night to the other. So that the one did not come near the other all that night. So not only did it work as this rampart separating the two, but it actually gave light to the Israelites so that they knew what they were doing in their camp, but it gave total darkness to the Egyptians. And so God was preparing the way for them to go. And then in verses 20 through 25, we have Israel's root became Egypt's root. Now, they're spelled differently. It's how do you say R-O-U-T-E? Route? Route? Some people spell, is it route? Okay. So it's route and route. Now, I know some people call it route. If you're from the Midwest or from the West or something like that, it's, you know, the route. Of course, my dad calls the things that you dig out of the ground ruts. They're not ruts. That's what you make with a tire track. But, you know, people have different dialectic pronunciations. But Israel's route, becomes Egypt's route. Now, route is a path. And we might take a certain... I'm going to say route every time because that's how I pronounce it. But if you take a route to the store, you take a certain path to get to the store, right? Or I used to have a paper route. It wasn't a paper route. It was a paper route. But I had a paper route when I was growing up. And, of course, that was the different places I'd go to deliver the papers. And so we know what a route is. A route, R-O-U-T, is when there is a chaotic retreat of an army. And that's exactly what we see taking place here with Egypt. Look in verse 21 through 25. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Now I have to pause for a moment, because if you read... some commentaries on this passage that do not believe in miracles, and there are commentaries out there that interpret the Bible without believing in miracles, they will tell you that this was some natural phenomenon where there was a tide converging with a certain wind and a low tide and a drought, and all of these combinations made some path through the water. Well, that's not the description that we have here when we have a wall on both sides of water. There was a division of this water, and then there was a dry land in between. There was a bridge made from the dry land. That's the route, the route that God makes possible for them to go through. And then verse 22, so the children of Israel went through in the midst of the sea, the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch, that's sometime between 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. So they had been passing through all night long. The Israelites had been going through this path all night long, making their way across the sea. And it says sometime upon the midnight, or after 2 o'clock, sometime between that morning watch, the Lord looked down upon the army of Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. The word can also be translated confused. Verse 25, and he took off the chariot's wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. You see how they're routed? God causes them to have this chaotic, confused, fleeing from the presence. Now we have some idea from Psalm 77, verses 16 through 19, kind of a commentary on this that gives us a little bit of more insight as to what took place. It says, the waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you, they were afraid, the depths also trembled, the clouds poured out water, the skies sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So that description there seems to indicate that while the Israelites were crossed over and the Egyptians were just starting to go into the water or into the path, that he sent this torrential rain. And the combination of the rain and the water then taking back place upon where it was before, the ground began to get soft. And the chariot wheels got stuck in the mud. And as the chariot wheels got stuck in the mud, you can imagine the Egyptians looking around and seeing their neighbor also his chariot getting stuck. And they see the wall of water beginning to lose its strength. And they're afraid. And they begin to flee. But before they are able to flee, we read in verses 26 through 29, their ruin. In verse 26 it says, Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So here they are inside this path, and their chariots are stuck and horses are no longer able to pull the chariots. They jump off their chariots and they start running back to shore. But before they're able to get back to shore, it says the waters came back over them. Verse 28, then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came to the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on the dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were the wall to them on their right and on their left. And so Egypt is ruined. The greatest and the best of all of their army, their soldiers, the ones that had been trained, the master charioteers and all their horsemen, dead. Just like that. God destroyed them. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 11, it says, and you divided the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and their persecutors who threw you threw into the deep as a stone into the mighty waters. Have you ever thrown a heavy stone into a deep water? I know that you probably have as a young child, or you've watched your kids do it, or even as adults sometimes we do that to see how deep something is. And the bigger the stone and the deeper the water, the deeper the splash, right? And so the idea, the picture there in that in Nehemiah is that a stone thrown in the mighty water. That's how it was, and the water came back down upon the Egyptians. Another picture that we have of that is in verse 26, I believe it is. It's 27. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing there. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The word overthrew there means to be thrown down or to shake off. It's what someone might do when you have a fly flying around and it lands on you. What do you do? You kind of go like that. Or, you know, the animals, they've got their tails continually flying, you know, hitting off the flies. Well, that's the image of this. The destruction that God brings to Egypt is just like someone going like this to a fly. The greatest and mightiest army of Egypt, gone like that by the power of God. So verses 30 and 31, we see Israel's rescue. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Well, I want to look now at some implications that we can gain from this passage. And I know I only got 5 minutes left or something, but we're going to work through these rather quickly. First of all, God directs us to achieve his glory. Why was it that God redirected the people of Israel from going one direction back another? From the Israelites' perspective, they were thinking, what are you doing leading us back here? Why are you leading us into this wilderness? And yet all the while, God was directing them so that he might achieve glory. He was doing this so that he might move against Egypt, and that his movement against Egypt might deliver his people and bring them glory. You know, a coach directs his team sometimes in a way that the teammates don't understand what he's doing. He may call a play, and they're thinking to themselves, why are you calling that play? And yet, when the play is completed and is done, the team wins, and the coach gets victory. Well, that's the same thing it is. If that is the way that it works in the coaching, the player, team situation, how much more? When God directs his people, is he able to bring glory to himself when that is completed? Imagine what the Israelites must have been thinking when they had traveled going around place after place, and it seemed like accomplishing nothing, continuing to square up against the sea. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt like God was leading you in one direction, and then about the time you felt like you were going the right way, he changes your course and leads you in another direction? And you think to yourself, what's he doing? Why is he doing all this? It's so that he might receive glory. You see, he directs us, and he redirects us for his glory. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 9 says, "A man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." Proverbs 20, verse 24 says, "A man's steps are of the Lord. How then can a man understand his own way?" God directs our steps and directs our paths so that he might receive glory. Secondly, fear and faith are inversely related. Fear and faith are inversely related. You know, it's amazing to me that Israel, after they had been miraculously delivered, after the 10 plagues, they had totally conquered Egypt, taken plunder, and left the land by the miraculous and wonderful power of God's hand. And they had exercised that faith by putting the blood on the mantle of the doorpiece and allowed the angel to pass over them during the Passover. That now they're crying out to Moses, "Why'd you leave us out here? We're about to die." You see how fickle man's nature is? Aren't we just like that? One moment we'll be praising God, saying, "Thank you, God, for delivering me from that. Thank you for helping me get up this morning and giving me the strength." And the next moment we'll be complaining, "Oh God, why does my knee hurt? Oh God, why does my back hurt?" We're just like that. The more faith, the less fear. The more fear, the less faith. I think of what Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue about his child. As soon as Jesus heard the word was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." And Luke chapter 8, verse 50, "But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, 'Do not be afraid, only believe, and she will be made well.'" And then, of course, the best picture of this in the New Testament is Peter. We always like Peter. Remember Peter when he was out in the boat? And the disciples see Jesus walking on the water. And they begin to be afraid until Peter realizes it's Jesus. And so he calls out to Jesus and he says, "If it's really you, command me to walk on the water." Lots of faith, right? So Jesus says, "It's me. Come to me, Peter." So Peter steps out of the boat. And he begins to walk on the water. But then what does it say? It says, as he's walking on the water. Imagine that, walking on the water. That requires some serious faith. But it says, while he's walking on the water, he looks around and he realizes the wind is boisterous. He's walking on the water and he's worried about the wind. But it says the wind is boisterous and he feels like he's beginning to drown. So he calls out to Jesus. And what does Jesus say? He reaches out his hand, grabs him, puts him in the boat. He says, "Oh, you of little faith, why do you doubt?" You see, we're just like that. One minute we're saying, "I'm walking on the water." And the next minute we're saying, "I'm about to drown." That's the way the Israelites were like. We see that over and over and over again. We see that in the wilderness wandering. One minute they're saying, "We're following Jesus." Well, we're following God. They didn't say Jesus, but we're following God. And the next moment they're like, "I'm tired of this manna. I'm tired of this pheasants. I'm tired of all these things," right? If you're afraid, what do you need? You need more faith. Faith is the power of God to work for your good. Let us call out to the Father of let us call out like the father of the demon-induced boy who had seizures in Mark chapter 9, verse 24, that said, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." And then in the third principle that we see here is attempting to do as God's people do without a relationship with God leads to destruction. Attempting to do what God's people do without a relationship with God leads to direct destruction. The Egyptians were following the Israelites through the same path. God had parted the water. They were going to go through the water, and they said, "Look, if the Israelites are going through it, let's follow them." And so they started to follow the Israelites. But God had a different plan for them, didn't he? And as soon as they got into the same path, the ground began to soften up. The rains came and they got their wheels stuck. And God defeated them there in the same path. Matthew chapter 7, verse 21. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? It's just like the Egyptians. We're going the same way the Israelites are going. There are going to be people in our day and in the days to come who say, I'm following Jesus. But then at the same time, it says in verse 23, then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. See, my children are able to do more in my household than another family's children would be able to do in my household. Why? Because they're my children. I have a special relationship with them because they are my children. And so although I enjoy other children's coming to my house, my children have rule and reign in our home. Well, not totally. Well, sometimes they have total rule and reign, unfortunately. But they're able to do a lot more because they have a relationship with us. Well, that, if that is true in our home, how much more in God's kingdom do His children have privilege? They do, because they have a relationship with Him. There are, unfortunately, some who in appearance may be trying to do what believers do. They may be going to church, they may be looking the part, they may be talking the part, but their destination is quite different because they have no relationship with the Lord. If you're like that, it does no good to pretend to follow the Lord. You must be one of His children. See, Christianity is not a set of rules to be followed. It's a relationship with Jesus. And then, number four, salvation does not mean perfection in this life. Salvation does not mean perfection in this life. We mentioned this briefly, but the Israelites have this tendency to be real fickle in their faith. God delivers them. Well, the way that it goes is the Israelites get into trouble. They cry out to God. God delivers them. And then for a while, they're like, everything's great. And then shortly after that, they begin to complain and grumble and get into trouble again. And then they cry out to God. God delivers them. We see this time and time. That's the whole pattern of the book of Judges. It's what happened to them in the wilderness. And it's what's happening here. God delivers them, leads them out into the wilderness. They're free. They get beside the sea. And what do? They complain and grumble. And so what this teaches us, I believe, is it teaches us that even though God might deliver us, His work is not done in us. You see, even though God might save us, even though we might be born again, even though we might be delivered from our sin, sanctification is a process. Wouldn't it be great if when we were saved, no more sin ever again? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great if when we come to faith in Christ, that's it? No more complaining, no more grumbling, no more lack of faith, no more problems, no more temptations. We're done. Well, that's not the way it works, is it? Even though we become Christians, even though we place our faith in Christ, His work in us continues as sanctification. The Bible tells us that our relationship with Him is that we are adopted children. We are when parents adopt children, do those children all of a sudden become perfect because they've been adopted? Nope. Some of these adopted children are thinking, nope. Right? So why do we think that when we come into the family of God, all of a sudden we're perfected? We can't be perfected. It's a process. It's a process of sanctification. So we must strive to remain faithful to the Lord and trust that He will complete His work in us. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 14, I'll end with this. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. That's, of course, a reference to this great event in chapter 14. All ate of the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink and to rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Therefore, my beloved brethren, flee from idolatry. You see, let the example of the Israelites and their cycle of disobedience, judgment, and deliverance motivate you to live by faith and obedience. For there is no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey.
Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
Not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Change your legacy. What will you do to change your